I guess the good news is that making too few source sheets means that that we had a good showing, so I appreciate that. I also want to particularly acknowledge that both my father and my wife Eliana are here, so I want to particularly thank you guys for coming. So this is our first opportunity to learn together, and I'm very excited. I wanted to, of course, the impetus for doing the shiur right now in this format is that I thought that we have an extra opportunity to study Torah, given that we're in sort of a holiday. It's not the 4th of July itself yet, but sort of leading up to it, to take some time to study Torah. We could actually decide whether, according to Dina de Mahuta, so it's not July 4th yet, but maybe according to, to the Jewish view, since the day starts at sunset, so maybe it is July 4th already, but so maybe there's a kiyum there. But of course, I just want to take the opportunity to study Torah, but also I think there is something valuable when we mark a special occasion, Jewish or not, to reflect on it, and not just to celebrate the 4th of July as Americans, but to think about what it means for us as Jews to be in this country. So, of course, and the way I want to frame Dina de Mahuta in some ways is that we have an opportunity to express our gratitude to God and to this country, and one way to do that is by being law-abiding citizens. But what's kind of interesting about this topic of Dina de Mahuta Dina is that it sort of predates any sort of notion of democracy or any sort of notion. It applied in both places where Jews were disadvantaged and persecuted, and also in places where Jews have had it well. So we'll maybe we'll see sources that maybe reflect both of those ideas of, on one hand, Akaras HaTovah, on the other hand, Dina de Mahuta Dina, maybe about staying out of trouble. So just some overall questions. First, we want to know what Dina de Mahuta Dina means. The law of the land is a law, but what does that mean? How does it apply? Is it a sin not to do, if you transgress a law of the secular land, are you additionally transgressing a Torah law every time you do that or not? So that's something we'll have to explore. And also sort of what are the limitations of Dina de Mahuta Dina? Does it apply? Does any sort of law on the American books also apply to apply as a matter of Jewish law? Or are there places where maybe Jewish law and American law or any sort of secular law don't necessarily jive well? So we'll explore all those questions. So the first source that I want to begin with is the Pasuk in Mishlei. So, again, already we're already going back to Tanakh in terms of the relationship between Jews and the government. And the Pasuk says, Melech b'mishpat yamid aretz, by justice a king sustains the land, v'ish terumot yarsenah, but fraudulent man tears it down. So there's a couple of things to note. First of all, actually, it's interesting that the Pasuk here uses ish terumot, a fraudulent man, so we're talking about Dina de Mahuta Dina, and one main issue as it pertains to Dina de Mahuta Dina is deceiving the government, taxes, and the like. So already here is that someone who deceives the government sort of tears apart the whole justice system. Right, and there's a mission of Pirkei Avot that also reflects this idea of how we relate to the government. In source 2, Rabbi Chinim Naskana Kohanim Omer Heveh Mitpala B'Shloma Shel Malchut, pray on behalf of the peace of the government, She Ilmalei Mora'a Ished Re'ehu Chayim Balahu. If not for the fear of the government, then human beings will swallow each other live. Okay, so what I think both this pasuk and this mishnah reflect is not necessarily a particular law. It doesn't tell us how to act in terms of what we do, in terms of following the law. But it does reflect a certain moral attitude that we have, our attitude towards government. Even this mishnah of Pirkei Avot was not necessarily the best of times for Jews. It's not necessarily the best of times for Jews. It was in a time, perhaps, of Mishnah was often a lot of the sayings of Mishnah come from times when Jews were persecuted, and nonetheless, we pray for the well-being of the government because it helps justice maintain, and it's better to have government than to have anarchy. So we have this sort of attitude, which, of course, even though it doesn't necessarily reflect halacha per se, it does affect perhaps what our actions would be as a result of that attitude. Okay, so those are sort of two introductory sources. The discussion of Dina de Mahuta itself, in terms of the force of following the law of the land, comes up first in the Gemara. The Mishnah Bava Kama says, this is source 3, It says, importing lo meteva ramochim velomikis shogabayim. One may not exchange larger coins for smaller ones from the trunk of customs collectors, nor from the purse of tax collectors. Veinot limehen tzedakah, you cannot take tzedakah from them. Aval notzel hu mitoch beito amina shuk. But one may take away money from the collector's house, or from money that he has with him in the market. Okay, so one's not allowed to exchange money from a trunk from the trunk of a customs collector or a tax collector because it seems like there's an assumption that they got it illegally, right? And you're not allowed to benefit from something that's done illegally. Okay, so there seems to be inherent assumptions that if you're a tax collector or a customs collector, you're doing something wrong. Okay, which maybe on some level we might like that because we don't necessarily love paying taxes, but the Gemara points out a problem here because the Harmar Shmuel dita de malchuta dina. So what do you mean that a tax collector, custom collectors are doing so illegally or non halachically? Isn't the law of the kingdom the law? So regardless of what halacha might say about the collection of taxes or customs, we assume that if the king is the one who's collecting the taxes, then that has binding force even on Jews. So one suggestion is that perhaps if the collector doesn't place a limitation, they just take as much money as they want, not within the bounds of the accepted even legal practice. Or alternatively, right? Perhaps, according to Rabbi Yonai, we're talking about a tax collector or customs collector who's doing it on their own accord and not with the power of the king, right? So if the king or the government sends a tax collector, so obviously they're allowed to collect those taxes, but if they're not collecting the taxes in a way that's justifiable according to the law of that kingdom, or the tax collector just does it on their own accord, but not with the standing of the, not with the backing of the government, so then that has no legal binding on Jews, and we don't say dina demalchuta dina applies there. Okay, and the Gemara gives a couple other examples of how this is brought. So, for example, there's a Mishnah that talks about whether you can wear a whole bunch of clothes on top of each other that are shatnez. Okay, so you can't wear something that's shatnez. So the question is shatnez, and if you want to do so in order to avoid paying taxes, because if you're wearing the clothes of shatnez, if you're wearing any garment, so the customs collectors can't tax you on that. So the question is the mutar to do it from kilayim? And then the question is also, right, well, how can you try to deceive the government by wearing these garments? If you're doing it in order to avoid tax, so you're deceiving the government, so how are you allowed to do that? So the Gemara gives the same answers here that either the tax collector was collecting far beyond what he should be collecting, or the tax collector is doing it on their own accord. And then there's also a third discussion in the Mishnah. Nodrin lahargin l'charami l'mafsin is still in source 3. So one may vow before murderers, plunderers, and customs collectors that a certain item is truma, and in that case they did not often if something was considered truma, so they didn't tax you on it for whatever reason. So you could say that even if it wasn't actually truma. That's what the Mishnah says. So the Gemara asks, well, isn't dina demalchuta dina? How can you lie and say that's truma when it's not in order to avoid paying a tax? So again, we gave the same answers that perhaps the custom collector is doing it without limitation, or a custom collector who does it on their own accord without the backing of the government. And all these statements, it's important to note, these are all wherever Gemara brings up dina demalchuta dina. It's brought by Shmuel. Okay, so this is a recurring theme that this particular Mora has this opinion. We'll just look at one more example in the Gemara where it comes up in source 4. Amar Rabba, Hane Tzlat Mile Yishtai Le Ukvan Bar Nechamya Reish Galut Mishmei de Shmuel. Okay, so there are three things that Rabba says that he learned from Ukvan Bar Nachme in the name of Shmuel. Dina de Machuta Dina, the law of the land is the law, Ve'arisuta de Barsai Ad Arba'im Shana. So if a sharecropper is working in particular land, even though by halacha the sharecropper can take possession of the land after 3 years, it only applies after 40 years, like the custom in Persia. And tax officials who sold land in order to pay the land tax, the sale is valid. Okay, so one of these statements here is, again, of Shmuel, that dina demalchuta dina. So what's interesting here is, first of all, whenever it comes, except for this case in Bava Batra, and a lot of the cases in the Gemara, when dina demalchuta comes up, it's sort of asking as a response to an issue, right? There's not even a Mishnah where it says dina demalchuta dina, right? It seems to come up as a response. But perhaps even more interesting is that nobody disagrees with Shmuel. So it seems to be a given that dina demalchuta dina. There might be cases where maybe it doesn't apply if the if it's not being done in a just fashion. But it seems like dina demalchuta dina is a standard halacha. Any questions up until now? Okay. I know this is not a shy group, so of course feel free to pipe in. So a question that of course we can ask about dina demalchuta, as I said, is that it doesn't seem to come up in the Mishnah. It seems to come up very sort of tangentially in the Gemara when other cases are presented. But what's the source of dina demalchuta dina? So if you had to take a guess, you think it's Doraita or Darabana? Is dina demalchuta dina something based on a Torah law or a Darabana rabbinic enactment? So it sounds like, at first glance, it would seem like it's Darabanan. But actually, that is pretty much a das yachid of the Beis Shmuel, who's a commentator on the Shulchan Aruch. Most poskim actually seem to believe that dina demalchuta dina is Doraita. One possible reason for that is that in some cases where dina demalchuta dina comes up, is, for example, in some of the cases we saw where if you're trying to deceive the government to avoid paying taxes, so there might be an element of theft or lying that's involved. So maybe that's one reason why dina demalchuta dina could be Doraita. But an interesting source to look at is Shmuel Aleph. Okay, this is source 5. Shmuel, in the book of Shmuel, as many of us are familiar with, the Bnei Israel want a king. Shmuel is not so crazy about them having a king. He consults with God. God says it's okay, but some conditions are put in place. So Shmuel explains that this is the practice of the king who will rule over you. He will seize your choice fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his courtiers. He will take a tenth part of your grain and vintage and give it to eunuchs and courtiers. He will take your male and your female slaves, your choice young men, and your donkeys and put them to work for him. He will take a tenth part of your flocks and you shall become his slaves. So in other words, the king is given a lot of power in terms of the property of other people. Okay? So, and the Gemara on Sanhedrin, based on this, says the following: Amar Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. This is source 6. Kol ha'amor parsha amelch melch muterbo. So anything that's said in this parsha in Sefer Shmuel, a king, even after times of Shmuel, is allowed to have it. Okay, Rav actually disagrees and says lo nimar parsha zo ela ayim aleihem. It's only meant to scare people off, but not necessarily that the king should actually do that. It's not that it's actually okay for a king to take people's property and tax people and the like, but it's meant to instill people the fear of the king, so they will follow the laws. Okay, but the halacha seems to be like Shmuel. Again, it's the same Shmuel, of course, who says dina demalchuta dina. So many poskim argue, including the Meiri and the Vilna Gaon, that the source for dina demalchuta dina, if we don't want to call it Doraita, it's definitely what we call Dibre Kabbalah, that it's based on a prophetic source, and it definitely has a larger binding force than a Din Darabana. That's
right. So the question I wanted to ask is, first of all, is that just the Shmuel Aleph, or is that the Shmuel Aleph also the board? And the second question is, the source that you're bringing out, that's where Jewish king over Jews. But how about a Goyish king over Jews, and especially with...
Speak up!
I'll repeat the question.
So the second question that I'm asking is regarding dina demalchuta dina, is that for a Jewish king to Jews, or is that also for a non-Jewish king or leader to Jews in that country? And there could be laws that are contrary to halakha, or halakha.
Okay, so two very important questions that we're going to explore even more in the course of this year. One is, does Dina de Malchuta Dina apply to all things? So that's going to be machloket that we're going to see in a few minutes. So that's definitely an appropriate question, right? It sounds like so far we've been talking about taxes or whatever. Rav Herschel Schechter says that the primary application of Dina de Malchuta Dina seems to apply to taxes, but we're going to see sources that really expand that. And the other question, we quoted Shmuel, so it sounds like a king for the Jewish people. Okay, so that's between Jews. You could say Dina de Malchuta Dina. But actually, post-game, like the Vilna Gaon Meir said that even though Parsha Melech is referring to a Jewish king, it actually applies to any king has those rights based on this. Okay, so what's the idea behind Dina de Malchuta Dina? We have sort of a couple of potential sources, either because not following the law of the kingdom perhaps brings you to transgress other laws, or perhaps because of the Navi Shmuel. But what's the theory that guides it? So there's a number of Rishonim that discusses, but two primary Rishonim that are constantly brought up in this discussion are the Rashbam and the Rashba. Okay, so Rashbam is Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, he's the grandson of Rashi, one of the Balei Tosfot. So he comments in Bava Batra that we say Dina de Malchuta Dina when all citizens of the kingdom accept upon themselves willingly the king's laws, and therefore they are binding. Okay, so the idea behind Dina de Malchuta Dina is that as collective citizens of a particular place, we sort of agree, we tacitly consent to whatever governing body. So therefore, by virtue of that, we accept upon ourselves whatever laws of the land. Okay, that's what the Rashbam says. The Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ben Adaret, in source 8 says, it sounds a little similar, but it has some different implications, that Dina de Malchuta Dina only applies with non-Jewish kings, as they can say, follow my laws or I will deport you because it's his land. In other words, if you have a king, and the king owns all the land, so he gets to decide everything. So if you want to live in his land, you follow his laws. If not, he can kick you out. Okay? So there's sort of similar similar ideas, but the attitude certainly seems to be different. The Rashbam actually makes a little more sense in a democracy, right? And here in America, as citizens, and we're governed by each other, so that collectivity seems definitely to be more in play. Whereas the Rashba and the Ran Rabbeinu Nisim of Girona, also with the Rashba, that seems to reflect an attitude in a more medieval in a monarchy situation. So perhaps a distinction between them actually goes to Matthew's question, right? If it applies to all laws. So according to Rashbam, it sounds like maybe all laws are subject to Dina de Malchuta Dina because we accept all the laws upon ourselves. But according to the Rashbam, maybe Dina de Malchuta Dina really only applies to a place where there's a king and he'll deport you if you don't follow. It sounds like because it's about his land, it's about his property. Right, so it doesn't necessarily apply to all laws, but it's about laws related to property. Fine. And Rav Asher Weiss seems to sort of reject both of these approaches, and he actually comes up with a different approach, which reflects a mission of Pirkei Avot that we saw before, that the political theory behind Dina de Malchuta Dina really goes back to that Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that says that if not for the laws made by the government, people would swallow each other alive. So it's not necessarily about, you know, the king kicking you out or what agreement we have. The idea is that we need a government. We need a government to make laws so that people will treat each other fairly and not kill each other. And that's why I have Dina de Malchuta Dina. Fine. Okay, so now we can get a little bit, I want to try to get to Maariv 9:10, so I'll try to sort of go through these sources quickly. Get a little bit to the scope of Dina de Malchuta Dina. When does it apply? So one of the big voices on this issue is the Meiri, Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri, who lived in 13th century Provence. This is in source 9. So he says, Kol Masha Marnu Bedina Machlut Shuitzlenu Din Gamarhu, right? Whatever the government enacts is considered a binding law entirely. Hukim Shechakak Hem Letolato Hem Letoele Nechasav Afilu Chakak Shehe Kol Adam Noten Lo Kach Lekach Veshana O Kach Lekach Maso Matano. Okay, so the idea of Dina, so the scope of Dina de Malchuta Dina is that it applies whenever there's a benefit to the king or to the Malchut itself. Okay, so that's actually an important point, because if you have a law that has nothing to do with the king, so if you have a dispute between two people, the government doesn't care how you solve it necessarily, has nothing to do with them, or it's not about taxes, right, doesn't benefit the king. So that might be a little bit of a different story. So Meir says, Alpha Pishu can negadin and cholanu dinhu, but asr la gozo alav or amashitik and shakaku rat wila mitzan malchuto. Right, so by this virtue, if the king wants to enact a law that's for the benefit of the general populace, so even if it's not the way we would do it in a Beit Din, we still have to follow that law because that was the king's decision. But he notes at the end that the Dina de Malchuta Dina does not apply. Dina Shah Umo Machziko by Hamitor Sifreham Vinusik Achmeham Akdumim Keneged Dinin Shalano. But if the law of the land doesn't really, it just comes from common custom, but doesn't really benefit in any way the general populace or the king itself, king himself, so that's not included in Dina de Malchuta Dina. Sheim can call Dina Yisrael B'Talim him. So that also sort of answers your question a little bit. That if a particular law is going to void a halacha, right? So we don't want to entirely lose the Torah because if you take it to absurdum, obviously, so you could say dina de malchuta dina, so you have to practice whatever religion is the religion of the land. So obviously Judaism would have been destroyed on that account. People martyred themselves for that purpose. So obviously it doesn't apply there. But even and less extreme cases, like let's just say laws related to wills. Okay, so wills are actually governed by halakha, are not necessarily subject to dina de malchuta dina. So that's perhaps, okay, so every government has a way to do it, but halakha has its own way of doing it. So maybe in that area, we don't say dina de malchuta dina because we still want to preserve our particular traditions where we can, where it doesn't necessarily undermine the authority of the kingdom. The Rabban has, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, Source 10 has a little bit of a stronger formulation and is a very clear formulation. He gives some very clear parameters. He says that we say dina malchuta dina when the laws are well known throughout the whole kingdom, when they are in practice with prior kings, they are written in the law books. But if the king decides on a whim to enact a new law to fine people or to do things as he wants, so that's robbery of the kingdom. That's not dina de malchuta. Right. 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 So that's what I was saying before that. Yisurim are definitely.
It's only money, whatever money they protect.
Right.
Like homosexuality, dina malchuta is not dina.
Right.
I'm not supposed to listen to that.
Right. Right. So again, so especially in the Ramban and in most of these sources so far, we've been talking about monetary matters. So these are three points that Rabban makes, that it has to have been a prior law, meaning that king can't have just decided that he wants to make people's lives more miserable and tax them more ridiculously, because that's not okay. And it has to be well known, and it has to be actually written in the books. In other words, it has to be like a real law. It can't be something made up. And the point is that it's a law of the kingdom, is a law, as the Rabban says, is dina de malchuta, not dina de malka. So it can't just be what the king decides, but it has to reflect in some ways, a certain system of law within that particular society. Many posts can reject the idea that it has to be a prior law, right? Obviously, governments can enact new laws, but the idea that it has to be practiced and well-known and make sense is something that's well reflected. Now we've sort of reflected sort of what parameters the government can do, when dina de malchuta can apply. But what about the entire legitimacy of a king? How do we define what's a legitimate government or not? So the Rambam, quoted by the Shulchan Aruch, I'm just going to say it outside, says that a king who mints coins and this is the second paragraph in the Rambam. When the king's coins are accepted throughout the lands under his control, for the residents of that country have agreed to him and have accepted that he is their master and they are to him his slaves. If his coins don't circulate, then he's a robber. So in other words, the king has to have some sort of legitimacy, right? And if he does have that legitimacy, so then he has the right to do things like eminent domain, you know, to seize people's property, cut down their trees, you know, make a bridge in their backyard or whatever. So the king has to have some sort of, you know, there's no king without a nation. Ein melech lo am, is the saying. So that's in terms of the legitimacy of the kingdom. Okay, so in terms of what the Shulchan Aruch paskins, so Shulchan Aruch says, I'll go to the ballpark. Kol shel davar. It's on page 6 in English. Kol shel davar. Kol din sheyachoch oto amelech lechol velo yel adam achab b'nei atzmo eino gezel. So if the king taxes everybody equally and doesn't just target one person or perhaps not just the Jews, so then that applies. It's not gezel from the king. But kol she yikach meish zebil vad. But if a king decides to target one particular person or one group of people, so that's chamas, that's robbery, that's, you know, that's a violent seizure, that's considered gezel. The Rama adds to this, Rabbi Moshe Isserwitz, the gloss on the Shulchan.
Taking it just from the rich.
What?
What about taking it just from the rich?
Just taking it from the rich?
The money just from the rich.
That's an interesting. So are you saying that he only taxes the rich, or he applies a different tax to the rich?
Only the
rich. So doesn't seem to be allowed according to the Mechaber.
Yeah, same.
Doesn't seem to be allowed, right? And the Rama adds that if a king wants to target one particular profession, that there's some that say that's not allowed, but some I guess we do say it's allowed. Okay, so here's an important point in the Rama. So the Rama says that there are some who say that dina de malchuta dina only applies taxes and customs that relate to land. Okay, it's very narrow. Okay, because going along the lines of the Rashba and the Ran, the idea is that the king allows people to live on his land, so they have to follow his rules. But other things are not subject to dina de malchuta dina. But there are those who disagree and say that we say dina de malchuta dina for every matter. Okay, so that's what he says here, and that seems to be his opinion here. But there's another Rama that's a little interesting in source 13. This is at the end of the siman where he says de lo amrina dina de malchuta dina ela bedavar sheyesh bo hana lamelech o shu takana bnei hamedina aval lo sheyaduna bedina ovdei kochav v'nim kein badu kol dina Yisrael. So the Rama adds at the end here that the dina de malchuta dina only applies when it has benefit to the king or when it's for the benefit of the society. That seems to be like that first opinion, that it only applies specifically in laws related to land or whatever. So Rav Asher Weiss suggests that maybe there's a contradiction here, but maybe there's a distinction between public and private things. That with private things, so dina de malchuta dina doesn't necessarily apply as strongly, but with public matters that relate to the public, so maybe there is a greater importance to dina de malchuta dina. Yeah?
So what about, for example,
the assassination of the king? That's a great question. So it sounds like, so certainly to the Yesh Omrim that applies to all things, I think it would apply there. To monetary things, it might not apply there, but remember that when we talk about Dina de Malchuta Dina, in many cases, there are other things that are involved with the issue. So with vaccinations, so by not vaccinating, you're causing potential serious danger to other people. So even if it's not Dina de Malchuta Dina, there might be other Yisurim involved. So, I mean, I would agree that from Dina de Malchuta Dina, it should be enforced, but if not for that, then the fact that causes danger to other people is certainly an issue. One thing I wanted to emphasize here, that the Rama sort of ties in the end, and this goes back to sort of Lenny's point also, is that there's a prohibition of going to non-Jewish courts. So the idea of Dina de Malchuta Dina doesn't mean when there's two Jews, right? So if there are two Jews involved, so Dina de Malchuta Dina doesn't mean that you just go to a secular court for any matter, but particularly pertains to things related to Jews and non-Jews, and especially if there's a Torah way to do it that doesn't undermine the law. So, for example, when it comes to divorce, divorce should be done in Beit Din, not in secular court, because it doesn't mean anything to the government how you do it. So, in order to preserve Torah law, so that has to be done in a Jewish court. Yeah. So that should go to Beit Din. The law doesn't require you if you. Right. Okay. So in that case, that definitely makes sense. But in theory, if it's just one Jew and another Jew, and so you don't have to sue necessarily. So in theory, that should be done. But there are definitely many exceptions to the prohibition of going to a non-Jewish court. But in theory, that would apply. Okay. So let's talk about, with 10-ish minutes left, let's talk about how this applies in America today. So first of all, as we mentioned many times, Dina d'Malchuta Dina is very much a tax issue, but Rav Heschel Schefter sort of offends that a little bit by the following. The Shulchan Aruch, in source 14, I'm not going to read inside, but it basically describes how there's an idea of shutfut, that people are sort of partners in a society. So residents of a particular city can force each other to do things that are both for the betterment of the city, right? You can force each other to build a wall around the city or whatever, or the Ramah says any needs, any sort of physical needs of the city, and also for religious matters, okay? So this is halacha shutfut. So Rav Heschel Schefter, YU, says that actually taxes today are shutfut, not dina d'malchuta dina, because we live in democracy where we all sort of fund everything together. All the roads and public services and everything, we all collectively fund those. So what happens if I don't pay my taxes? I'm effectively stealing from other people, right? A, maybe causing taxes to go higher if the government doesn't have enough money. And you're stealing from other people because even the minority can force the majority according to halacha. So the fact that we all sort of live in this land together, we all collectively fund. There's no king, okay? So the fact that we all sort of govern each other means that we all have to take our part. So you said that actually taxes today is shutfut. What about a case of a store that doesn't pay sales tax? So obviously the store is required, Jewish or non-Jewish or whatever. But let's just say Jews own the store. So obviously by halacha they're required to pay taxes. But what if they don't? Am I allowed to shop there? So Rav Schefter, in an article in the RJJ Journal, quotes Rav Soloveitchik saying that it's forbidden by the cause of lifnei iver, because you're causing somebody else to do an iser by not, when you buy something and the store is not paying sales taxes. So, it doesn't invoke dina d'malchuta dina here. Certainly that might make sense on some level, but it's also lifnei iver. Potentially. I didn't see anything specific, but it sounds like it's similar, right? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to skip source 16. It's an interesting question about income tax. Basically, what Moshe Feinstein says there is that if you have, I'll just say quickly outside. If you have a charity and you have an individual, when the individual gives to the charity, it's tax deductible, right? As far as I understand. Okay, so that's tax deductible. So should that deduction go to tzedakah? I'm not really sure why anyone would think that the tzedakah should get that, profit of the deduction instead of the taxpayer. But Rav Moshe says that that the dina d'malchuta is that for an income tax, the individual gets a deduction, not the organization. So that's one way he applies it. Another discussion that Rav Moshe Feinstein has is regard to an issue of rent control. So what I love about this tshuva and a couple other tshuvas he has is that he's asked this question about rent control, which I'll explain in a second. But first, he says that a couple issues. Number one, Dina d'Malchuta. The guy, the second question.
Yeah,
Okay. There's the person who asked the question asked if Dina de Malchuta Dina, if Ramosha could explain a theory on Dina de Malchuta Dina. Ramosha says, you know, it's very complicated. There's a lot of contradictions. As we've seen, it's not necessarily so clear-cut when it applies and when it doesn't. So he doesn't want to give a theory. It's a little bit beyond him. But another reason why he doesn't want to do it is because Shabal Yidra'ech, this is source 17. Shabal Yidra'ech, Chas V'Shalom, She'anu Maktinin Kevod HaMalucha D'Meditin HaTeinu Bepet, Asher Anu Mechuyavim La'kir La'hem Tova La'cheset She'osim Imanu V'alkol Achinu Bnei Yisrael She'medina Hazot. Okay, so what Moshe is saying here is that he doesn't want to discuss Dina de Malchuta Dina and such people because he doesn't want for any second to suggest any sort of lack of gratitude to America. Moshe was born in Bolshevik Russia, as far as I know. And of course, up until now, a lot of the sources we discussed were dealt with in times when Jews were under governments that weren't necessarily so friendly. So especially now, when we are under a government that has done so much good for us and to the Jewish people and to all of its citizens, and we pray for its well-being, so he doesn't want to do anything to suggest anything negative and to suggest that maybe there's situations where the law of the land doesn't apply. He has this overall attitude of Hakar Satov. So the question that he was asked was, it's not written in the Tshuva, but in one description of it that I saw, was that there was a rabbi who, there was like, I guess, two apartments next to each other. There was a rabbi who lived in one, and there was another tenant in another, and the rabbi wanted to kick out the other guy so his son could move in there. And the question was, could he somehow legally do that? So Ramosha says it's not even Dina de Malchuta Dina, partially because rent control was already in effect at that point. So rent control, first of all, prevents the landlord from jacking up the price, but also prevents the landlord from kicking out the kicking out a tenant. Right? It serves within that time you're not allowed. It provides a certain provision, but in theory, if the tenant wants to stay there longer, so they have the right to do so. So if it was before rent control. So maybe we could discuss Dina de Malchuta Dina, if the halacha allows it, if the halacha does or doesn't allow the person to be kicked out, if the second law does or doesn't allow the person to be kicked out. But certainly once the laws related to rent control are in effect, so there's no discussion of Dina de Malchuta Dina, because that is, there's a certain understanding when the tenant signs a lease, there's a certain understanding that they have the right to stay there as long as they want, as long as they pay the rent and sign the lease. So that's the custom of the land. The tenant and the landlord had that understanding when they went into it. So that's the custom of the land. It's not even Dina de Malchuta Dina in that sense. I'm going to skip this discussion on adverse possession, which is something that Rabbi Yonah Rhesus discusses. It's a very fascinating thing. I'll cite briefly a couple of tshuvas related to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein has a couple of tshuvas related to schools and education. And one issue was whether it's okay for students who are taking the regents to get the answers in advance or to somehow cheat so that they could get good scores and that will it'll make them look good. So Moshe says it is absolutely forbidden, not just because of Dina de Malchuta Dina. Okay, so again here, this is, Dina de Malchuta Dina might be a factor, but there's other factors here also. And he says it's actually stealing because what's going to happen? Person passes the regents, and then that's going to lead them to a good college, or even if they're going straight from high school to a job, right? If they have a good score, so it'll help them get a good job. So the person's hiring them because they appear to be smart, and they really didn't take the test honestly. So when that person gets hired for the job, they're actually stealing money from that employer because they didn't necessarily rightfully get that job. So that's one tshuva of Rav Moshe. And another tshuva, this is in source 20, don't have to read it inside, but this is another tshuva where Rav Moshe, waxes upon, how great America is and how much it's done for it. And the question is, if the yeshivas are getting services from the government, are they allowed to exaggerate the number of students or somehow, underreport things so they can get more money? And Rav Moshe says, first of all, we have to have so much Hakar Satov to America for all that we've done. And not that Rosh Yeshiva would ever think of being over on Dina de Malchut Dina, first of all, but also Gezel and lying and deceiving and whatnot. But we have to just make sure that everyone who's involved in schools has to make sure that really everything is being done honestly. And at the end of the day, it reflects much better on the Jewish people when we when people see that the yeshiva students act according to the law of the land. So even if there was previous, you know, tenuous relationships between Jews and Jews and non-Jewish governments, and maybe in Russia, maybe, you know, under czars, maybe it was more okay, but certainly in America, it's not okay. So especially as we're coming to the 4th of July, I love that formulation of Ramosha and both of these tshuvas about how our acting, being law-abiding citizens, is especially an act of hakaras hatov to our country. I just want to end by talking about quickly about traffic laws, because I named the shiur is speeding a sin. I'm sure we all want to know what the answer to that is. So in different sources I looked up, these sources from Rabbi Ari Wasserman and Chabad are somewhat similar. It seems to be taken for granted that Dina de Malchut Dina applies beyond beyond taxes. It applies to other laws. Of course, traffic laws are meant to protect people, so obviously there is a big, if you go according to the opinion that Dina de Malchut Dina is about bettering society, so certainly traffic laws preserve that. But sort of an interesting question is, what happens when something's not enforced? So the example from Chabad.org actually gives an example of some really wacky laws that if you Google them, you can find all these crazy things. I can't walk backwards at a certain time on a certain day of the week while eating a donut or something like that. So if you did that, that does not undermine Dina de Malchut Dina. But what about if you're going, you know, if you go 56 in a 55 mile an hour zone, is that an avera? So it seems to be that most posts seem to say that if the law is not enforced, meaning that the police are generally not going to pull you over in that situation. And actually, there's a citation here that even John Roberts once said on the bench that that he drove 60 miles in 55 mile an hour zone. So if the Chief Justice is, you know, does it, then it's probably okay for the rest of us to do it. But obviously, if you're going 80 in a 55 mile an hour zone, so that might be a transgression of Dina de Malchut Dina, but also you're endangering people, and that's a very severe prohibition. So I would take more questions, but I do want us to dive in Maariv at a reasonable hour. So I just really want to end by quoting the preamble to our Constitution that says, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for a common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States and America." So I think this actually, in some ways, encapsulates, granted that we saw many different opinions about Dina de Malchut Dina works, I think it does encapsulate some of the ideas that we saw here over the course of this year. The number one, taxes provide for many needs of our community, especially when we're all sort of equal citizens in that endeavor, so we all sort of share that responsibility together, and we should do so honestly. But also this idea to form a more perfect union, if that's the goal of the United States, that fits in very well with what the Meir was saying, that if the taxes are meant to better society and the laws in general, the laws that we have are meant to better our society, then there's nothing greater than we can do than to actually follow those laws. So with that, I wish everyone a happy 4th of July, and thank you for being here.